All right, open your Bible, please, to Judges chapter 1. Our reading today is Judges chapter 1. We're going to read from verse 1 to verse 22. If you have a Bible that's got those cross-references in it, you'll find that a lot of the references go back to Joshua. And in fact, what's happening here is that a lot of this, they're just recapping what happened in Joshua. And so it gives you the impression when you first start reading, this is what's happening now. But in fact, if you look at some of those references, they're giving you the exact same events. So just keep that in mind as we read it. And we'll work through it a little bit later. But the first verse gives us the context of when Judges actually start. So after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? And the Lord answered, Judah is to go. I have given the land into their hands. The men of Judah said to the Simeonites, their brothers, come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We in turn will go with you into yours. So the Simeonites went with them. And when Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands. And they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. It was there that they found Adonai Bezek and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and Perizzites. Adonai Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Then Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. The men of Judah also attacked Jerusalem, and they took it, and they put the city to the sword and set it on fire. After that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country, the Negev and the western foothills. And they advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron and defeated those three kings. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir. And Caleb said, I will give my daughter Aksah in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Debir. And Othniel, who was the son of Kenaz, who was Caleb's younger brother, he took it. And so Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to him in marriage. And one day, when she came to Othniel, she urged him. And she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? And she replied, do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper and the lower springs. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms, that is Jericho, with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath. And they totally destroyed the city. Therefore, it is called Hormah. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, Ekron, each of those cities with its territory. And the Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. And as Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from it the three sons of Anak. The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites, who were living in Jerusalem. And so to this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. And so on the story goes, but we'll only go that far today. I've entitled it, and it might help if I turn the... Hang on. There you go. All right, so reading was Judges 1, 1 to 22. Our title for today... Play hard or go home. I got that from someone else. I didn't make that up. In my younger day, when I was a platoon commander, we used to go off on army exercises. And we had this adjutant. An adjutant is a captain, usually their first promotion on captain. He was a regular army soldier. He came from the 3rd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, which in those days was the parachute battalion. So it was an elite. They considered themselves elite. So it's the case. I mean, there's not too many people who did parachuting in those days, a few commandos and some of the SAS. But the adjutant is the commanding officer's personal assistant or secretary. And what would happen, you go out on these exercises, 16 days, we go out 3 weekends plus 2 weeks in between. And you get to probably around about the second Tuesday. And it might be raining. Now, if you're out in the scrub and it's raining, I can tell you it gets harder. And some people at that stage started to do a little bit of complaining. Not anyone in my platoon. Can I just get that straight with you? No one in my platoon. My morale was high. But some of them would. They'd start complaining. And things that would happen would be like, oh, sir, I need a leave form. Well, I've got to go to work on Friday, and the exercise doesn't finish till the following Sunday. And it was amazing. All these people, I don't know what the connection was. It rained. They had to go to work on Friday. You know, I can understand a farmer. It's rained. I'll go and do some sowing. But in those days, we didn't have mobile phones. And so if you knew you had to leave early, you had to put in your application on the day you marched into camp. The adjutant had a word or had a saying. He said, play hard or go home. And what was he saying? He's basically saying, give it your all. Put in a full effort. I don't want a half-hearted effort. And that's always the case. I work with people. I don't want the half-hearted people. I don't want the slugs. I want people who are going to put in a full effort. I want them focused and concentrating on what's going on, doing the best they can. And I think there's a lot of that story in here with Israel. When they went into the promised land, don't go in half-hearted. And certainly in battle, if you're going to go in half-hearted, it's a good way to get yourself or your mates killed. One of the things we saw last week was that this book is about what happens when you disobey God. And one of the ways of disobeying God is just to go in half-hearted. So we'll go through this story and have a look at a couple of things that come out with it. And there's a couple of nice little challenges come for us. So what are we going to do today? I'm going to split it into four parts. I want to review for you. That's the first part, just a review from last week. If you weren't here last week, see Dominic. He can give you a copy of the tape from last week. I think, Dom, today you're doing a 3-for-2 deal. Buy two, get one free, I believe. Yeah. Psst, the first two are also free. So part one is a review. So if you missed last week, it's important to go and get that. Part two, we're going to look at the up campaign. Well, there was a reference in there talked about Judah going up. So we're going to look at the up campaign. Part three, we'll look at the down campaign. Now, you can almost memorise this. And part four, guess what? We're going to do a conclusion. Okay, so that's where we're up to today. Let's go back. Let's look, simply by way of review, let's look at the structure of the book of Judges. It's pretty easy. There's a double introduction, there's the cycles in the middle, and there's a double conclusion. Okay, so the double introduction is Judges 1:1 to 3:6. That introduction is split into two parts. Part A is about foreign wars applying the principle of harem. Judges 1:1 to 2:5. What God said is when you go into the land, you are to utterly destroy the people in the land, everything. And that was the principle of harem, to utterly destroy. And you may have picked up that word in, I think it was verse 17. So that's part A, foreign wars. Part B is difficulties with foreign idols. And that covers that section from 2:6 to 3:6. then moves on from there to what I call the cycles. Most commentators will call it the cycles. I stole it from somebody. Judges 3:7 to 16:31, and see stories of various judges or groups of judges. And it's called cycles because you have this cyclical behaviour. And we had this diagram last week, where you have Israel, or one of the tribes of Israel, usually wasn't at this particular incident wasn't the whole of Israel, but it was one or more of the tribes, where Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord. Dom, a little test, can you turn that front set of lights off, please? Just check the... That's all right. Good. Is that too dark for anyone? Some of you who are writing. Sorry, it might just sharpen it up a bit. Israel does evil in the sight of the Lord. God therefore disciplines them by sending them into captivity or in subjugation to another group of people. The third bit is that Israel will serve that group of people for so many years. What then happens is Israel cries out to the Lord in distress. And God hears them and he delivers them through a judge. A judge, remember, is simply a tribal leader who in the first instance is a military leader. And because the God spirit is on that judge, the people are taken out from under that captivity or subjugation. The oppressor is therefore subdued and the land has rest. And then the cycle goes on again. And what we said with the book of Judges is that as time goes on, there's degradation. And we even get to the stage where right at the end, Israel doesn't even bother crying out. And so that pattern is degraded as you go through. But that's the essentials of the middle part of the book. Double conclusion. The double conclusion is Judges 17:1 to 21:25. And again, it's split into two parts. Part A, difficulties with domestic idols. How can Israel have difficulties with domestic idols? Well, they did. And that's that 17:1 to 18:31. You see that? What was happening at the beginning? Difficulties with foreign idols. Now they're having difficulties with domestic idols. Something has gone wrong here. And part B, there are domestic wars under the principle of harem. They're civil wars. They've degraded so much they're fighting amongst themselves. And they are applying the principle of harem to totally destroy. Nasty stuff. When your country gets to civil war, you know there's a problem. And that's Judges 19:1 to 21:25. So if you can remember that. So start, double introduction, right? The wars, the problems with idols, the cycles in the middle, and at the end, the double conclusion with difficulties with your domestic idols and then the domestic wars. So if you've got that, you've got a good grasp of the structure of Deuteronomy. No, not Deuteronomy, Judges. All of this, of course, keeps going back to books like Deuteronomy, which we read last week. In the reading, Judah and Simeon were mentioned. Notice how Judah actually is surrounding Simeon. Right there towards the south. You also have in the middle there is Benjamin. Right in there. Judah and Simeon were the second and fourth sons of Leah. And Benjamin, of course, was the youngest son and he was the son of Rachel. On that map, Jericho is in about here. Okay, I haven't got a very steady hand. Just a bit to the south and west is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is probably about 20 kilometres from Jericho. You come further south, about 50 kilometres, you'll get to Hebron. Head west about 20 kilometres and you get to Gibeah, if I pronounce that right, the one we had in the reading. Come down further. And you'll come into that place, Hormah, as well, which is further down. So it's down around about here. Hebron's about halfway up the Dead Sea. So we'll see those places. And in terms of the distances, they're not big distances like we have in our country. They're quite close, these places. Admittedly, you've got problems of topography. If you go from Jericho to Jerusalem, anyone taken that trip? Good, then I can say what I like. But it rises up quite steeply. I forget what it is. I think Jericho's actually below sea level and Jerusalem is quite high. Again, you can look up the exact figures, but there's a lot of issues with topography. All right, so let's go to part two. Let's look at the up campaign. Just before I get into the two campaigns mentioned, a little point to make. The question is asked at the beginning, who will go up first to fight? And that's the question given. And it seems like that this was a question asked when they first went into the land. But it also seems to be a question that's asked after the death of Joshua as well. What's happened is with Joshua, they went into the land. There was about 7 years of campaigning. And then things quietened down and people seemed to have lost the plot. They weren't interested anymore. Remember when I said go hard or go home? It seems like Israel want to go home, right? They're half-hearted, and there's at least 20 years where they really are not doing any of the conquering of the land. The initial part basically broke the back of most of the Canaanites, but people didn't follow up and completely destroy them. Remember, that's what God said, you have to completely destroy them. However, at this time, there seems to be some reinvigoration, and people are asking, well, who should go up and fight? And it seems like that they're asking that to the Lord. And so that's a good thing. It's a good question. It's a good question to ask, Lord, what should I do? Yeah, fair enough. Lord, what should I do? That's a good question. But the thing is, though, sometimes we ask that, and we get an answer. I'll do that bit, but I won't do that bit. It's not flat-out defiance, but sometimes we just shift it a little bit. And so we'll see that in a minute. But it's a good question to ask. Lord, what should I do? Who should go up first in this question? So it's a good question. And Judah is told to go up first, and even later on, I think you'll find that is the thing, that Judah is the, in that military sense, I would say, the leader of the tribes. The thing that's a little bit off, and this is what I mentioned a moment ago, when you ask the Lord, what should I do? And you get an answer, and you almost do it. What happened was that the tribes were told to go into the land and possess their territory. So Judah was to go into the land, and Judah was to fight for their territory. Benjamin was to go into the land and fight for their territory. Manasseh was to go into land and fight for their territory. See what I'm saying? But what did they do? Judah formed an alliance with Simeon. So it's a little shift. It's just a little fracture, a little crack. But it will open up greatly in the years to come. And so the challenge there is to do the complete will of God. And just again, if you're making notes, if you want to refer to that, those two, Judah and Simeon, were the second and fourth sons of Leah. So it was natural that they had that alliance. And the other sons, there were, what were the six sons of Leah? Anyone confirm that for me? I think there were six sons and a daughter mentioned in Scripture. Then you had another six sons through other women. But the connection between Judah and Simeon, they were full brothers, so it seems to be a good connection. So let's have a look at the two campaigns. So firstly, we have a victory at Bezek. They went into the land. I'll find the map in a minute for you. But when you go from Jericho, you go into Jericho, and then it seems like they've headed, the Bezek that I found, they headed north and a little bit west. Now, if you remember that map, Judah's territory was where? Down south. Yeah, it was. Thank you. Sarah memorized it. Good on you. Someone paid attention. Good. So it seems interesting that it seems that they're actually going into other areas. So there could be an issue here. I'm not certain. But there may be another Bezek, but that's the one I found. So if you look at a map, you may find a Bezek for yourself. Sometimes you'll see it spelt with a Q on the end. But they go up. So who are the characters? The emphasis in Bezek is on Adonai Bezek. It says that they went up, they totally smashed the place. A great victory, it would seem. It doesn't say they totally destroyed them, but there just seemed to be a victory. But did you notice how many people were slaughtered up there? It said 10,000 men. Now, secular scholars will go, oh, come on, don't be stupid. There's not that many people there. Or, it's not an exact number, it's just a big number. They just mean a big number. You know, it's like Wagga Wagga. Wagga Wagga means place of the many crow, I believe. No one can tell me for sure, but is that right? Dancing is another meme. Dancing stairs, all right, I'll take that back. But the Aborigines used to have counts. They'd have one or two, and then it was many. And what a lot of secular scholars say is what they mean is it's just lots of people got killed. But here's a question for you. Is that what it means, or do they mean 10,000? And in the context, we know that governments inflate casualty figures of the enemy. When the Vietnam War was on, the Americans used to inflate their casualty figures of the enemy. But actually what someone said, they were counting all the leaves that they shot up as well. But it's common that people will inflate the casualty of the enemy. But I'm not saying that there were exactly 10,000. Maybe it was 9,927. Yeah? You see what I'm saying? We use that. If I say to someone, can you come out and do something for me? And you say, oh, hang on, in a minute. Do I sit there looking at my watch, timing you? Yeah, I do. No, you don't, do you? It's only a short time. So you use it in a figurative sense. In the military, though, if I say a minute, quite often I mean a minute. If my platoon's ready, we're at our line of departure to start an attack, and I'll say to the sergeant, you know, how much? How long till H hour when we have to go? Oh, a minute. Oh, well, let's go now. It doesn't matter. Let me assure you, that's a very good way, because what's happening is you've got fire, artillery fire probably coming across the top of you. You might have someone out on the side who's firing, who would fire, and they may start firing right on H hour. So if you go early, you're exposing yourself, either being hit by your own artillery, or if you've got fire support from, say, a machine gun, you go too early, the enemy will be able to easily neutralise you. So I make a little bit of a point about this, that when you see a figure like 10,000, does it mean 10,000, or is it used in a figurative way? And without anything else to indicate, I would say, yes, they mean 10,000. To say it might not be exactly 10,000, but the same way we use it. How far to Wagga? 100 kilometres, most of you will tell me. But some will tell me it's 103.2. Or if you go this way, it's only 99.8. Would you say I'm lying if I told you someone comes to town and says, how far to Wagga? And I say 100 kilometres. You tell me, am I lying? No, you know what I mean. So there's a degree of accuracy. And we could do a whole series on the degree of accuracy in far as numbers are concerned. So when it says 10,000, I think they mean 10,000. And just to add to that, how many Israelites came out of Egypt? I've heard figures 2 million. Even 3 million, there were a lot of people around. So don't buy into that secular thing that says, oh, no, those numbers are way too big. Right? The Bible says 10,000, unless you have indication that it's used in a figurative sense, then it means pretty much that number. All right, Adonai Bezek, what happened with him? Had his toes cut off? Well, you can't run very far with your toes cut off, can you? You can't even stand up. You need your toes for your balance and to give you that forward momentum. Had his thumbs cut off? It's pretty hard to work without your thumb. Okay? How much do we do using our thumb? It's as simple. So you can't cope without your thumb, or not very well. So Adonai Bezek, but it also indicates the complete power that Judah had over Adonai Bezek. It's So it was a complete victory. And he says, I've done this to 70 other people before. He said, they're just picking up crumbs under my table. But what did he say? And this is the key in this little part. There's the first person he's quoted. But basically, what does he say? I got what? I got my just deserts. God has given me my just deserts. And there's a recognition by this pagan that God has given him his just deserts. Now, to be technical, he didn't say Yahweh, as the Hebrews do, so he may not have understood who was Yahweh. But there was certainly a sense there that God has given him justice. In contrast, one commentator said, look at the grace that God gives to Israel. This man got justice, and he recognised that. And so point B I would make in this section. So part A was the victory at Bezek, and then part B is success at Jerusalem. And it seems like they then went from Bezek and headed south down to Jerusalem. And so possibly 50 kilometres or so. They head south. And they smash into Jerusalem. And what did it say in the passage? They destroyed it. Again, a comprehensive victory. The Simeonites are not mentioned in this case. Did they stay with them or did they push off to somewhere else? I'm not certain. But great success. And so what we're seeing in this story is success at Bezek, success at Jerusalem. And that's important. But then you have that comment a bit later on. Let's just remind ourselves there in this part. It's said in verse 8. The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also, and they took it. And they put the city to the sword and set it on fire. And as we'll see later, there's a comment about the Benjamites and what happened. So lots of successes. A little bit of a question mark about the alliance, but successes. So let's go to part three and look at the down campaigns. The capture of Debir is the first one. It's an interesting one in this case. And they go to Debir. Have I got a map for that? No. Debir, I think Hebron about there, say around just a little bit above the middle of the Dead Sea. And if you go that 10 to 20 kilometres west, you'll probably come to Debir. Okay, so down, that's where they are now. I'd like to know where they are. And Caleb, Othniel and Askar are the people spoken about here. And Caleb says, if someone goes and takes the city, they will be a hero and I will reward them. He's not going to give them an MC or a VC, but what he will do is give his daughter in marriage, the daughter being Askar, of course. One hopes that Askar is a better deal than the MC or VC. But Othniel is the hero and he is rewarded. And that's the point. One of the things that you will notice about Askar, she's, I think, from this passage, quite an impressive person. She's assertive, she takes the initiative. And we're reading the story then, what did she do? She asked her father for a field. Now, it seems the way it's written that it's compressed something, the way the story is written. If you go to verse 14 rather. One day she came to Othniel and urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off a donkey, Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? It seems like they've compressed two stories there, that it seems that somewhere along the line, that she received land. It says a field. I don't know how much land that was. Perhaps part of her dowry. But she went to her husband or at some stage, whether it was before the marriage or after, and asked, go and ask your father-in-law for land for me. And then she goes even further. But then she goes to her father and says, well, you've given me land, now give me some water. And you see the point? That's pretty smart. It's a fairly dry area. So it's no good having the land without the water. So she shows initiative very much so in that sense. Was the land part of her dowry initially, or did it come later? I don't know. It's interesting that what she's doing, though, is she's strengthening her dowry. Having the land's fine, and Othniel gets some more land, but by putting the water to it, she's adding value to that land, and therefore adding value to their relationship. So she's building something here. And having that land and the water will have really good consequences for her and Othniel, their children, and subsequent generations. In the ancient world, land is important. Having land. But for the Israelites, having land is important, but it's important not just because of the fact you're an agrarian economy, you want land, but it's important because it shows God's blessing. And that's the point about it. Having land is an indicator of God's blessing. And you do not buy and sell that land easily. You don't want to let it go. Even today, some people have a strong sense of the importance of land. And one farmer comes to mind. I think he said he was the fourth generation on that land. He said he didn't want to be the one to lose it. And he did, you know, something that was quite dramatic to make sure they maintain their farm. But having land to the Israelites is an indicator of God's blessing. Because what did he say? Go into the land and I will give it to you. If you didn't have any of it, if you were tossed out, what does that say? You've lost God's blessing. So it's important. So it's worth dwelling on that. Othniel is a hero. He's mentioned later on. He's one of the judges. He's mentioned as a good judge, somebody that's worth emulating. Some of them weren't. But Othniel is seen is a good example. One of the other things we notice is that Askar and Othniel were cousins. We read last week how God said, do not intermarry with the Canaanites. And therefore, this is following that principle. She's married, in this case, even within her own tribe. That's important because there's a contrast later on with Delilah and Samson. Askar, as it were, stands by her man. She adds value to their property. She adds value to the relationship. And yet when you see Delilah and Samson, who was the worst of the judges, Delilah doesn't stand by him. What does she do? She brings him down. And so it contrasts with that later on. So there's these nice little things that are happening in terms of the literary structure that gives us some lessons. So Debir was captured. So that was more to the west in the hill country. Part B then is the Kenites move to the Negev. Again, they moved probably down around about here, down towards that bottom third of the Dead Sea, just on this side. They moved down there. How did the Kenites get into the picture? What did it say? The Kenites came from Moses' father-in-law. One of his sons, at least to start with, hooked up in some way with Moses and then the children of Israel. They were living probably on the eastern side of the Jordan when Moses first came across them. But from the story we see, they must have joined up with the Israelites because it says they were at Jericho. They came up from Jericho with the Israelites. So in some way they've joined up with the Israelites. I'll just get the right slide. I changed these this morning. That one. What's interesting about the Kenites? Here is a foreign group. They're not Israelites, and yet they've been blessed by association with the Israelites. And that's the point I want to make there. God said, when you go into the land to destroy the people that are in the land, he did not say, destroy all the people in the world. There's a difference. It was very specific. The people in this land you are to destroy. And look, they must have been bad, really bad, if God said to destroy them. But the Kenites joined with the Israelites and were blessed as a result of that. And the connection here is they'd say to the Israelites, do not live amongst the Canaanites. But we're said here in this story, did you notice it says the Kenites are living amongst the Israelites? The other way around. So they've taken those people in. So the third part there, point C, is the destruction of Hormah, or the original name that was given there. Again, we see an alliance by Simeon and Judah to destroy that particular place which became Hormah. And it says they destroyed it utterly. Verse 17, I think it is. Let's just check. The men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath. And then they totally destroyed the city, and therefore it was called Hormah. And then it says they also took other places like Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. But it says they totally destroyed. That's that word harem, to totally destroy. And that's only one of two times it's actually used in the book of Judges. So they did what they were supposed to do, right? They followed the commandment of the Lord. Again on there, so we're moving further down south here. The Kenites are in here and probably in that area is where Hormah is. So they destroyed it under the principle of Haran. So, but again, there's a story of success. So we've seen some stories of success. Why are you getting that picture? But there, you know, are some failures. What does it go on in? I think it's the next verse, and it says, but they took the hill country, but they couldn't take the plains because they had chariots of iron. So what you've got is a military situation here where when you're facing someone who has got better armaments than you, you've got a few problems. And that's what often happens. Out in the open country, the enemy can deploy their artillery, they can deploy their armor, their tanks, they can deploy their vehicles to move their infantry, whether they're APCs, ASLAVs, Bushmasters, whatever they are. And the point about that is armor and mounted infantry move quickly. There was a Confederate general who said the principle of war is to get there fastest with the mostest, and that's what you do in open country. You can move quickly. And they had a real advantage against the Hebrews. But what happens when you face that situation? You have heard of guerrillas and the partisans. Where did they hide? Out in the plains? No, even your World War II stories. They hid in the mountains, because when the enemy comes for you, the infantry have got to get out of their vehicles and they've got to take you on man by man in rugged country. And so militarily, it's not surprising that they didn't win. However, here's a question. Should they have been able to beat this technologically advanced group of people? Your answer should be yes, because God says he would give them the land. Now, I don't know that they were going to do it overnight. I don't know that they were going to do it without casualties. I don't know that they were going to do it without learning something or being very sneaky. But they still should have been able to do it. And so this is a failure. They did not take the more open countries. It's probably that country towards the Mediterranean Sea. So there's a failure. So we've seen some successes. we've seen a couple of failures. And they also comment on the failure of Benjamin. Why comment on Benjamin? What's he got to do with this story? Well, of course, earlier we said that Judah had gone down and smashed Jerusalem. They destroyed the place. And then it says that Benjamin, because Jerusalem was in Benjamin's territory, that the Benjamites did not utterly destroy the people, and they let them into the city, and now they're living amongst the heathen. Right? It's the opposite to the Kenites. The Kenites were living amongst the Hebrews. Here you've got Hebrews living amongst the heathen. What happens when the enemy's coming? People often scatter. Like a bunch of kids smoking out behind the shed. Right? Teachers coming, they scatter. But that's what you do. And when Judah first came down to Jerusalem, I suspect that some people scattered. And they probably dealt with all the ones that were there. Made a real mess of the place. But after a while, they started coming back. And the Benjamites didn't deal with them. And so that was a failure. So, let's just finish up here. By way of conclusion, part four conclusion. What I want you to do, and we've talked about successes today, so this, celebrate your successes. Challenge. We're talking a little comment that Barry was making this morning, that sometimes we are whingers. And no matter, and Barry said, we asked somebody, how are you? Was it you that said that? They give you this woe to me, whinge, moan, groan. Celebrate your successes and spiritually celebrate your successes. Remember, if you believe the Lord's, I believe God's guidance is to do A, B, or C. And hey, I've done that. Tick it off. Keep notes. Believe I should be doing this. And you can come back and look at it next week, next month, next year. Tick it off. Yes, I did that. Celebrate your successes. And in that sense, acknowledge the blessings of God. It brings you to thankfulness. Not big noting yourself, but you've been thankful. Important. Three. And I believe, actually, just to come back, just as a comment, I believe that the press secretary for President Trump, Sarah Sanders, I think she starts her press conferences quite often with, I want you to give me, if someone wants to ask her a question, I want you to give me something for which you are thankful. And if you're talking about journalists who hate Donald Trump, they're out there trying to put the boot in. But she turns that around, or she reads a little story of something about being thankful. I think it's a good little illustration. We jump very quickly to the whinging. And yes, there are some things and difficulties that we all have. But let's acknowledge God's blessings to us. But let's also be realistic and acknowledge the failures. Because if we don't acknowledge the failures, the little crack just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's a lot of what we'll see in this. You may have even something today. You go home, you know, think about, maybe I haven't acknowledged my success in some things. And some of you are probably a glass half full sort of person. Some of you may be a glass half empty sort of person. So you've got to go a little bit stronger and be very intentional about whether you're celebrating successes or whether you're acknowledging failures, depending on your personality. But maybe there's something there is that you can go home today and say, yeah, something went well. I did follow what I believe is the word of God and celebrate that success and acknowledge God's blessing. Or maybe there's a failure that I need to acknowledge and move on from that. So we're going to be radical today. Sarah and her team are going to finish off with a song, I believe. There's massive morning tea out there. I think the owner was someone involved in that. Used to catering for big eaters, so it might be compulsory that you have to have two pieces of everything.